The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, a lot of you already know that we lost another legend in the business last Monday, August 13th. Jim the Anvil Neidhart passed away at the age of 63 years old. Natalya paid tribute to her dad at SummerSlam on Sunday by wearing the same pink and black ring jacket that the Anvil wore at SummerSlam 1990 when the Hart Foundation defeated Demolition to win the WWE Tag Team titles. So I wanted to pay tribute to Jim as well, and Natty and TJ thought it'd be a great idea to release the interview I did with her dad in the fall of 2016. It was the last in-person interview, in-depth interview that Jim Neidhart did. We think it was actually the last interview he might have done, period. Jim sat with myself and his son-in-law, Tyson Kidd, TJ Wilson, told all kinds of great stories from his wrestling days. He shared what really happened in the locker room the night of the Montreal Screwjob, because he was there with Brett when Vince came in right after the deed went down. Jim talked about the Hart Foundation, WrestleMania 2 with Andre the Giant, his time in the dungeon with Stu Hart, and the Calgary wrestling scene, plus how Jim ended up there after growing up in Southern California. So in honor of the late, great Jim the Anvil Neidhart, here's the interview, uninterrupted in its entirety, paying tribute to the Anvil, the rebroadcast of Jim the Anvil Neidhart's last interview done in the fall of 2016. Anvil, you were one in a million, my friend, and this one's for you. So enjoy it, and let's hear, raise one up for the Anvil.
Okay, so we're here at the amazing house of I'm not even going to bother with Tyson Kidd. You're going to call you TJ, because yeah. I'll get it wrong 100 times anyways.
Everybody hits me with both names all the time.
Yeah, so you're now officially TJ. And we got the amazing, legendary Jim the Anvil Neidhart here. And I'm really excited to do this interview, Jim. And it's really cool because you've had a long history in living in Tampa, even though family was always Calgary-based, right?
Yeah. I came down here to Tampa after I worked that territory for Bill Watts in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got used to living in Florida, I wasn't going to move.
Yeah, I get the feeling.
But it's hard too, because like a lot of guys like Brett and Owen and like Lance Storm, they stayed in Calgary and worked in the States.
Well, that's where Brett belongs, is back there in Calgary.
Yeah, stay there.
Yeah.
He's like a Calgary guy.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But you're not from, are you Canadian?
No. I beg your pardon. No, I married a Canadian.
Right, you might as well be at this point.
Yeah.
But where are you from?
I'm from Southern California.
Okay.
I went to high school in Newport Beach.
Gotcha.
But living in Florida is really, really good out here. It's mm-hmm. more reasonable.
Right.
And I don't know how those people in California deal with that traffic.
Yeah.
It's too much.
Well, it's getting that way even like up in Calgary too, but out here you don't have that issue. And also, like I said, the traveling, and it's something that people don't realize, especially when you're talking about how much traveling that we do in the WWE now. But
they would never be able to comprehend it.
Yeah, exactly. Especially back in your time in the WWE, when you guys were, when people say nowadays, oh, we're on the road 250 days a year, whatever. You literally were on the road. Like, what was your schedule when you were working with the Hart Foundation when you guys were hot?
Oh. A schedule is just basically you're working every day, and you might get one day off every 2 or 3 weeks, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But for most part, just like all this, pretty much every day.
So, but we would be was it 30 days? What was the old schedule, Teach? 30
yeah,
days
I,
on, one day,
yeah,
two
I
days
think
off
Jim's told me before, right? You just show up at TVs, you get your booking sheet and
yeah.
your big stack of tickets.
It was supposed to be 3 weeks on, mm-hmm. 1 week off. 3 weeks on, 1 week off. Well, not good. It was just basically 4 weeks on, and that's it.
Okay.
Don't like it too bad.
Yeah, what else are you going to do, right?
Right.
And so they would give you a big stack of airline tickets, because this was before.
Yeah. Yeah. Tickets.
So you would get your tickets. And
I saw those tickets, and I used to look at them and then ponder my thoughts. I said, what I'm basically doing is making a huge figure eight around the North American continent. Vancouver to Miami, up to New York, and back to LA. It's like, God almighty.
We used to call that, we still do call it the Star of David booking, where it's like boom, 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 up to the whole star, you know?
Oh my God. Trying to do that travel schedule and actually use your body for a living extremely hard. But we did it, right, Chris?
TJ? Well, yeah, we did do it. But that's what I'm saying. Like back in that 80s style, like how could you guys work, you know, 30 nights in a row and travel every day and training every day? I mean, that must have just been, no wonder a lot of the guys are just crazy, you know, mentally.
Oh, yeah.
I know Mike Rotundo told me that's why the Sheik snapped. Iron really? Sheik. He said, hey, Tyson, nobody did as many days. He's like, he did like 95 days.
That's good.
Wow. Yeah. That's ripped off from Harry, of course.
Of course, of course.
Well, you know, talking about the Sheik, Sheik would always go, I said, Sheik, look at this schedule here. It's too much. He goes, seriously, Jim? Seriously? I said, yeah. Sheik, seriously, this schedule is too much. Oh, I see what you mean.
and then away they go.
Yeah, off they go to another month of bookings. So would you be, I've always been wondering about this, would you be responsible for that stack of tickets? Did you ever lose the tickets? Or would you ever, like, I'm sure, like, did one fall out of your bag? Or did you have to grab those things and hold them like gold?
That's why I got this fanny pack on. It never goes anywhere. It's just on me.
That's got to be why, right?
No wonder the guys in the 80s wore the fanny pack.
Passport packs. And the tickets go right here in my fanny pack, and that's it. There ain't no one's going nowhere.
So you would stick them all in there.
Oh, yeah.
See, this answers the eternal question of why fanny packs are so popular amongst wrestlers in the 80s and 90s. Seriously.
I love my fanny pack. And if I ever see anybody else walking around with a fanny pack on, I had to run over there to them and say, where the hell did you get that fanny pack at? I can't find a good one anywhere.
Are they getting harder and harder to find?
Oh, yeah. I asked this lady in a luggage shop and the Tampa airport. She thought I was crazy or something. I said, it's just a little bag you strap onto your waist. You put your stuff in there. She goes, what? What are you talking about? Oh, never mind.
So we mentioned how you have a connection with Calgary and the fact that you married, you know, one of the Hart sisters and spent some time in Calgary. How did you end up originally going to Stampede and working for Stu?
When I was released by the Oakland Raiders in 1979, I was wondering what the hell to do. Mm-hmm. And somebody suggested that... these guys making money wrestling and doing pretty good. I've never wrestled anybody in my life then.
Have you ever watched it? Did you ever watch wrestling at all?
I really didn't like it.
Gotcha.
I think also Jim was super busy. He's dedicated a lot of time prior to that to shot put, and he went and competed in Russia in shot put.
Okay.
And then later on with the Raiders. So I don't think he even...
Yeah, right. Wrestling was just something that was around, but you weren't into it or anything like that. So... when someone suggested it to you, what were you thinking?
I couldn't believe it. You know, it's like, well, I've never seen it before. You know, on TV a little bit, Channel 5 out in Los Angeles. And I didn't really know exactly what I was getting into.
So why Calgary? I mean, you're in SoCal.
That's another good question, Chris. Why Calgary?
We're still wondering the answer.
Going from Southern California, Newport Beach, 70-degree weather all year long, that's sunny, right. Beautiful, to go to Calgary. All that snow and...
Yeah. So how did that come? Because you mentioned that you watched it on Channel 5. Why didn't you just go up the road and see like the LaBelles or Roy Shire or one of those guys? Why go all the way to Canada to work
for Stu? The Bells, I saw Gene LaBelle and I was inquiring how, you know, just exactly how do I do this? You know, how do we get in the business? And so Gene LaBelle called Stu and they arranged that for me to go up there and learn. It was a good place to learn, just like yourself, you know?
Right, right.
All those Calgary guys end up doing pretty good.
So that was kind of the standard. Like, if you go train with Stu, then you'd have a good training? Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah. To train with Stu?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Jim's actually hands-on trained by Stu himself.
Wow, because by the time I got in there was, so you, that was, you're looking about 80, so I was about 90. So Stu at that point was over training. He was done training. He was very old at that point. But you actually had the hands-on Stu Hart wizard. So what kind of stuff would he do with you?
Oh, he was really sneaky. I go down to his basement. I'm waiting for him to come down. All of a sudden, I see this old man coming down the stairs. Who is this guy? With bare feet and like a little itty bitty pair of underwear on or something. I said, oh my God, he can wrestle in that shit? Oh my God, I wasn't. So he put in those submission holds by Stu Hart was a real eye opener.
Well, because he must have loved you, because Stu was always, he loved big guys. You know, he would always grab.
Strong, right?
Grab your arm.
What he'd do is he'd put you in a submission hold, mm-hmm. and he'd crank on you a little bit and get you to squeal. And then he'd go from one submission to another submission to the leg submission. God almighty.
So you're walking out of after this, you know, this old man is just beating the hell out of you. Did you...
We locked up for a good half hour, an hour, just locking him. He was just bullying around with me in the basement, back and forth, like, you know, wear me out or some shit.
Stu wanted Jim to kind of push him around and maybe tire himself out a little bit first. So they're down there for like an hour of like first Jim kind of like, you know, bullying Stu around. And then Stu... going into this demonstration of hold. And I tasted them in 1995, so in 1980, I can't imagine what it felt like.
That's funny. Yeah. What Stu did, once you got in the basement there, he would go, he whispered in my ear, he goes, let me have you. That's the way he talked. let me have you. Don't fight it. Let me. I said, what do you mean? You know. So I was basically giving him my body. another bad mistake.
Right. Well, that's how he would do it, though. He would go, let me see your arm. Yeah. And then you'd give him your arm, and then he'd put you in some ridiculous hole. It's like, wait a second. You can't be a shooter by someone giving you your arm.
Yeah. You know what I mean? That's what we had to do.
Right.
Take it easy. Let me have you. After the first couple of days, I said, Sue, that shit. Right. No one is going to have me or, you know,
you're not having
whatever it is, I ain't going out without a fight.
Well, because you must have been, I mean, you, like I saw you earlier today, when I haven't seen you in a few years, you look pretty much exactly the same. You must have been strong as a bull at that point in time.
Well, to come out of the Dallas Cowboys and double sessions and shit, oh my God.
I mean, how much were you weighing then?
Ooh, probably around 280.
Wow. And that's 280 solid.
Yeah.
You know, solid muscle and a lot of power, too.
I got down as low as 255 one time. You wouldn't recognize me.
Yeah. So when you first started with Stu, you mentioned, like, did you take to the training pretty quickly?
No, nobody takes that kind of shit, training of Stu's. You're down there in that basement. Most of the time, it's so damn cold, you can't even stick your nose outside the window. Mm-hmm. And to work with Stu in that horrible, stinky basement.
Well, that's the funny thing, too. People talk about the dungeon with such... revered. When you actually see it, it's basically, like you said, it's a dingy little basement with a ring that I recall being maybe 3 or 4 inches off the ground. It was more of a boxing ring than anything, it seemed like.
It had a little
with no ropes,
give.
Right? Yeah. A wall.
Right.
Three sides of a wall and one side of nothing. You have to pretend as a rope.
Pretend as the rope, yeah.
Yeah, it had a little give, didn't it, DJ?
Yeah, a little touch. Like when we actually tore it up when the house was sold, the mat was so worn down and so thin, and it was over top of like these little boards.
Right.
And it was like...
And not very, very high off the ground.
Nope, not at
like
all.
A normal ring.
No, and to think like, man, we've been bumping on this.
But what, remember, TJ, what the real problem is with that basement is,
you can't breathe.
You can't breathe, and there's a huge pipe.
Oh, yeah.
On the ceiling. It's about 6 feet off the ground, so you had to duck through that every time you do something, you know?
Yeah,
basically three rope sides, one pretend side, and a big pipe that you have to duck underneath.
And then trying to mess with Stu, you know.
Yeah. Oh,
so
man.
Did Stu teach you how to bump as well? Because I know
Bruce Hart
Bruce was involved.
Gave me some professional wrestling advice there. And
Gotcha.
And just how, you know, the Japanese guys showed me how to land flat on your back.
There was also always a lot of guys hanging around, you know, Stu's house.
Oh, God, every bum in the world was out there.
Did you stay at the house?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I had lived for a while in the back of Stu's house, in that servant's quarters kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was real nice.
Was it?
I had Stu at my door every morning looking around and stuff.
Yeah, but looking for what?
Oh, looking for something. Looking for me, looking, you know. If I was drinking any beer or doing any shit, you know, you always had one eye open.
Oh, yeah. Well, you were kind of his project at that point.
Yeah, I think he definitely took a huge liking to Jim right off the bat, and he did instantly become his project.
Who was your first match against?
Oh, it was, I was just hanging around my house, and all of a sudden, Stu goes,
why don't you get in the car and come down to the matches?
What? You want me to go to the matches? Oh,
it's
God.
The nerd, Stu Hart. So you went down?
I went down. And that's where it all started.
Was it in Calgary or?
Yeah, at the Calgary Pavilion.
Yeah.
The old pavilion there. Beautiful place to wrestle.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the whole place had a great seat.
Right, because the seats kind of went up.
Yeah.
They rose up.
A small little stadium effect. It was really, really a good place to wrestle.
Do you remember who your first match was against?
Oh, yeah. My very first match was against a guy called Duke Myers.
Yeah.
He was a great guy. I remember Angel Acevedo, the Cuban assassin. Mm-hmm. He had helped me a lot, and that Duke Myers had helped me a lot.
Because Duke was a big guy as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
Other than that, nobody would say a word. I mean, no, I wouldn't get any help from anybody.
Really?
Yep.
And so they're kind of, were they trying to just knock you into the business, you know, the right way, or were they just being rude, or were they being dicks? Or,
well, you know, breaking into this pro wrestling business is not easy any way you look at it.
Right.
We've all had some kind of horror stories just breaking into our business, you know?
Did you have any?
I had a bunch.
Let's hear them. What happened?
I can remember Stu Hart coming down those metal steps into the basement. Mm-hmm. And he put on these, what we call the woolies. Mm-hmm. He put on his woolies every night, which was like a little itty-bitty bikini type of wrestling thing.
Right.
It was really small. I said, oh, my God. I'm gonna, do I have to grab this guy? With like, oh, I wasn't counting on this. You know?
Right.
So I've never wrestled in my life ever. Mm-hmm. Not amateur, nothing.
What did you start out as? Jim Neidhart? Was that the name they gave you? Was it Jim the Anvil Neidhart?
The Anvil came after I got persuaded to be in that Calgary Stampede Rodeo. And I got invited to throw this 100-pound anvil toss. Like, oh my God, I'm going to break my back with this thing. This is ridiculous. It's too heavy. Uh-huh. You should try throwing a 100-pound implement. You can do it any way you want to. You can run with it. You can pull it over your back, your head. You can do any, you know. But if you've ever tried to throw something that weighs 100 pounds, very, very unusual. You should try it sometime.
Well, I don't think I can. I don't think it's something the average person could do.
Well, I bet you that you have got really strong hands and wrists. You just got to hold on to the son of a bitch.
But it's an anvil. It's an anvil's got a point on one end, and there's a little platform on it. And how? What do you?
You kind of scoop it a little bit.
Are you doing like a shot put? Do you turn around?
No, I try that. Nothing was working except either you can hold on to your shoulders and take a little running start, mm-hmm, and throw it off the top of your shoulders, or you can like put it between your legs and try to throw it over your back and shit.
Okay.
No matter what I did, it was the same distance.
How far were you throwing it?
Oh, over 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm. But what are you throwing it, like 2 feet? Are you throwing it 10 feet? Did you win?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Of course. Yeah, duh.
And everybody and their uncle was out there trying to throw that anvil. All kinds of football players and weightlifters and, mm-hmm, hockey players. And
well, but then so that's how you got the name The Anvil.
That's it. Because I'm basically the official world record holder in the anvil toss at the Calgary Stampede.
Really? To this day?
Yep.
Well, that's, yeah. Like, who else is going to do that?
Who else would want to do it?
Yeah. But I always heard the stories about how strong you were and how strong you are. I think
it's not so much the strength as I was a world-ranked shot putter back then.
Yeah.
I was high school national champion. And I was about, at one time, I was sixth in the world pre-Montreal Olympics.
Okay.
I was getting ready to go to the Olympics.
All right.
But in the United States, you have to qualify like a week before the games, you know. It's like, oh, it's really nuts.
So that wasn't something that you were interested in doing? That's why you didn't go to the Olympics?
Oh, no. I was plenty interested in it. I couldn't qualify. I think I'd thrown 65 feet, 1.5 inches, and that wasn't good enough.
Oh, I gotcha.
In the United States, we had two or three world record holders in men's open shot put.
Wow, okay.
So it's like, oh my God, to make the Olympic team or even get close, I'm going to like break a world record or some shit.
Well, the thing is, though, you might not have made the Olympics, but you are the world record anvil tosser in the Stampede.
Chris, you're absolutely correct one more time.
So there you go. So, you know, that's even better. Okay, so that's how you got Jim the Anvil, which I always wondered, which is cool. But also you talk about Calgary and that promotion.
My mother-in-law, Helen Hart, gave me that name, the Anvil.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, she was really quite bright. Uh-huh. And Helen Hart had given quite a few of the wrestlers some of their names.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just like family folklore, but supposedly she had a lot to do with Gorgeous George too, the original Gorgeous George.
Really?
Helen had a lot to do with, like, maybe the music and maybe
the pomp and circumstance.
Yeah, and part of his look supposedly was always like, I was always told that ever since I was around the house.
Because so many people came through Calgary that could make sense, right?
Yeah.
Can make sense. So Helen, what did Helen say to call you the Anvil? Just because you had won the contest?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I was looking for a name. I didn't want to be Jim the Animal.
Were they calling you that for a while?
A little bit.
Okay.
Just a little bit. And then the Anvil just came along perfectly, and Helen Hart gave me that name.
Yeah.
And it's been working ever since.
Yeah, it's a great name. I love the fact, too, that it's Neidhart and the Hearts. I mean, it's just, it's like it was meant to be that you'd be involved with the family. And You know?
Yeah, people get real confused by that.
I'm sure they do. So tell us about when you started with Stampede on the Road, because you always hear the stories about, you know, driving in the vans and the long trips and all that sort of stuff in the middle of the winter.
Oh, my God, driving in the van. Well, every week we had to go to Regina.
Mm-hmm.
500 miles there, 500 back. And you're in a van with about four or five seats in it, and Stu Hart crammed so many wrestlers in that thing. Crammed about 10 or 11 wrestlers were in the same thing. We were just packed in there, going 500 miles up, 500 back, and all the beer and everything in between.
And also, too, sometimes in the freezing prairie winters as well.
Oh, no kidding, freezing.
Did those things ever break down at all?
Did they break down? My God. if you're out there and you're on that Trans-Canada Highway, 2 or 3 in the morning, in a bad snow blizzard, you don't want to get stuck out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a couple of times our van, it was so cold, the van froze up while we were driving it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But the engine block actually just froze.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that people down here don't understand, like that you have to
plug your car in.
Oh, yeah, don't plug your car in. Forget about it.
Yeah. I drove my car down to Knoxville to work for Cornette, and it was a Canadian car, and there's all these guys that come up to you all the time going like, you got a wire hanging out of the front of your car. I'm like, yeah, you got to plug it in. It's like, is it an electric car? It's like, no, if you come from Canada, you got to plug the damn thing in to warm the engine blocker. It just freezes. And trying to explain that to people down here, of course.
I drove mine from Calgary, so same thing.
Yeah,
funny.
Who were you working with in Stampede at that time?
Well, there was Angel Acevedo, the Cuban assassin. There were Duke Myers, Bruce Hart, Wayne Hart was the referee, Keith Hart was another wrestler.
Mm-hmm. Brett working there too?
Oh, yeah.
So you knew Brett from that time as well?
Dynamite
Kid, Davey Boy Smith.
Right. What great chemistry you guys had with those two.
Well, they're really, really good. You know, as yourself, you know. We all watched what Dynamite Kid was doing. I try to copy everything he did, the way he did it, you know?
Yeah, but you can't. He just had that natural instinct and that style that it's just
he was so good.
Original, you know?
He was so good. Everything that Dynamite Kid did was absolutely perfect form, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He had a really good mind, too, for finishes and everything.
Really?
Yeah, Brett's always told me that, too.
Really? Did you work with him in Stampede a lot, Dynamite?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I work with him and Davey Boy quite a bit. Yeah, if you're wrestling Dynamite Kid, it's a great, great pleasure. It's like a night off.
Mm-hmm.
He's great.
Right.
Basically, he's doing all the work.
Well, that's the thing, though, for a guy your size and a guy his size, he just has to run at you and bounce around and that sort of a thing, right? But you're pretty agile, too, for a big guy.
Yeah. Oh, Dynamite was way more than just a tackle and bump around guy, you know, kind of guy. He could wrestle anybody and make it a good match. He was really, really polished and really good.
See, that's the thing. When you go to Stampede and you talk about how you've never wrestled or really knew much about wrestling, you're working with some of the greatest of all time in your early years. I mean, that's probably how you started learning so quickly and becoming so good so fast.
Well, getting really good instruction like that, you're learning to wrestle. So I'm practicing in Stu Hart's basement in the ring there. And then you get into a match with a couple other wrestlers and you're just starting out.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to start out. I mean, especially starting out on TV match.
Mm.
Oh, my God.
Right, right.
If you're not used to it.
Well, that's the thing, too. I remember when I started, Stampede had just closed, but there was a little company that was at the Silver Dollar Action Center.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. What was his name? I can't remember what his name was that owned the place.
Frank Sisson.
Frank Sisson. There you go.
That's where we'd watch every pay-per-view.
Frank Sisson, yeah. But, you know, you're on TV, you know, and I had maybe 10 matches, but you go on TV, it's a whole different thing. It's very intimidating. because,
oh, yeah,
you know, you make a mistake in Rimby, Alberta, who cares? But you do it on TV.
So it lives on forever in your mind, right?
And everyone's seeing.
See, I had no problem with wrestling on the TV and everything. What the deal was, what the real sticky thing was, is after your match to go and we did our interviews right after that.
Ah.
And so you're in the ring still with all your gear and your sweat and everything. And now you got to get on the mic with some with our broadcaster, Ed Whalen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do some kind of an interview. And I also exhausted that for, you know, I could barely get the sweat off me.
Yeah, barely breathe.
Oh, I could barely breathe. And, you know, Whalen, the TV guy, give me all these hard questions and everything. Right after my match, live on TV, like, oh, my God. I don't know. Leave me alone.
Heck of an answer.
That could have been your gimmick. He's just the cranky wrestler. I don't know. Leave me alone. Go away.
As a baby face.
Yeah. Did you have the beard back then, too, the goatee? Or the Van Dyke, actually, if you want to get correct about it?
No.
Okay. Was that something you just grew in the WWE?
I think I grew it when I wrestled for Bill Watts in Mid-South Wrestling down there in Louisiana.
Okay.
I just grew it out there a little bit, and then all of a sudden it got so big. It was such a long beard. My beard's kind of stiff, too. So here I had a flat top, because I always try to be like Dick the Bruiser a little bit.
Oh.
Try to get that look that he had with a flat top and all that. Then I threw the beard in there on top of the flat top with the sunglasses. This is different. No one else is doing this.
Well, and it's funny, too, because, you know, you know how you have certain memories from your childhood, and obviously I grew up as a wrestling fan, as the TJ, but I'm about 10 years older than you, maybe, or whatever it is. So I grew up in the Hart Foundation, you know, WWE Bulldogs, and Jim the Anvil Nighthawk with the beard. Now, so many guys have long beards, but that time you were the only guy in any wrestling or even rock band or whatever that had that long beard. It was your trademark.
Which scared Harry as a kid. Oh. Harry was like deathly terror. I mean, also because he probably used Bulldogs against Hart Foundation on TV. But Harry as a young kid was deathly afraid of Jim. And a lot of it, he thought, when he thinks back to it, had to do with the beard.
So how was it working for Bill Watts? You talk about, you know, you go from the extreme cold of Calgary to...
Yeah, I got all my stuff in my convertible Cadillac. And I drove down to Louisiana to work down there. When I arrived there, I had a wrestle that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so exhausted. And Bill Watts never gave us a day off in 6 months. Nothing.
7 days a week.
Yep.
4 weeks a month for 7 months.
Yep.
Wow.
No days off. It was just crazy.
Here's the thing. Like, we say, oh, it's crazy. That literally is crazy. Like, I can't imagine. The most I ever did in a row was Hamburg, 6 weeks, which is, what's 7 times 6? 42 in a row. This is seven... Wow. I don't even know.
In Hamburg, you were in the same town every night, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, same venue every night.
That was easy. Yeah, a lot easier than traveling.
But what was the Louisiana territory? Was it the same seven cities every week, or was there like was New Orleans kind of a base, and then you kind of bop around?
New Orleans is kind of our big base there, and you go to Baton Rouge,
mm-hmm.
places like Houma,
Lake Charles is near
Lake
there,
Charles, Little Rock, Arkansas,
Biloxi.
And...
So how do you do 7 months every day? Like, that's 200.
Well, having all that, the stuff that we went through in Calgary, mm-hmm. we'll get in that van, all that shit.
Drive through the winter, so maybe it was almost like a day off.
Oh, yeah, it was like a day off. I said, this is great. You know, we have to do that 500-mile trip. Like, oh, my God.
I think Calgary at that time was 6 days a week. It may be some once in a while seven as well, but it was like Friday was Calgary, Saturday was Edmonton.
We might have gotten a Sunday off every now and then.
Yeah.
Really?
Maybe.
But just physically to go that many days around mentally, too. I mean, you're just, that would wear you down, man. I mean, I can tell you right now.
You get used to it.
And you just become just as a robot then.
Yeah. So all those Calgary guys, we all had a little edge on anybody because we were brought up in that territory and learned that way.
And even like ribs and stuff like that, because I'd always heard, like, it's like the old Frank Sinatra song, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere, talking about Calgary. I'd always heard, like, you know, from like, it was a heavy rib territory as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're driving.
Well, that's a rib in itself. But I'm talking about the actual guys ribbing you, is maybe not for you so much, but I heard as time went on, especially in the 80s, that it was a really bad kind of a rib area.
Well, number one, you have to find some way to pass the time.
Mm-hmm.
In the van, you know, so, you know, a few things you can do.
Which are?
pulling ribs on everybody. Especially the new guys.
Were you a rib guy? Did you rib those guys?
No, not really. Not like Davey Ware Dynamite.
They were bad, right?
They were real bad.
What kind of ribs would they pull?
Don't fall asleep in the van, for God's sakes. Yeah. You'll wake up with no eyebrows. I don't know.
Just the dumbest thing in the world. Yeah. What does it even do? Like, it's 30 seconds just going. Like, that was, I'd always heard to, like, putting Crisco on the stairs. Ron Ritchie told me one time they put Crisco on the stairs. So a guy basically, like, slips and falls down the stairs.
You're guaranteed to fall.
Like, you're almost dying. Like, there's the rib on you, you know?
What we did was a good little deal. There's a couple guys in the van that weren't very popular. So what we ended up doing is going out and getting two or three large family packs of X-Lax and kind of melting them down a little bit and put them in a Swift Current, put it in a chocolate malt and mix it all around. I had a couple of boxes of X-Lax.
Oh, my God.
So we put in this guy's chocolate shake and go, hey, anybody for a hamburger? You want this chocolate malt here? You know, oh, yeah. So we all watch him drink the chocolate malt to the very last drop, and then we wait. We still have about 5 hours to drive, and this all of a sudden, whoa, we got to stop for a piss call. Okay, 5 or 10 minutes there, we got back in the van. We got to stop again, our 10 minutes. This went on for like 3 hours of going, stopping.
Which goes back to the whole, like, ribbing yourself to rib yourself. Yeah. Well, they make the 5-hour drive into a 10-hour drive.
What was really odd was the guy that ate all the X-Lax, the only way for him to help was like he got outside the van and ran backwards.
Okay.
Why he did that, I mean, we don't know, but I said, just keep doing it. You know, so that'll help.
So that's why he did it.
You know what? There was, do you remember the time that I think it was Davey, and I think you guys were both doing it, but you guys would put Tiger Balm onto the Visine bottle. So when someone went and got some Visine, they would get the Tiger. This is the story. I don't know if you remember this, but Davey Boy did that, and you took the Visine. Do you remember that?
Yeah. If you don't know what it is, it's really scary.
Oh, yeah, no kidding, right? All of a sudden, a little bit
Davey
of Tiger
Boy,
Balm.
Davey Boy put some Icy Hot on the Visine and left it, and his own brother-in-law was the one who used it and didn't know. You're like, Davey, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. Your eyes start burning and shit.
Was this in WCW?
Yeah.
Davey
must have known right away that it was Davey that did it.
Oh, yeah.
He must have still tried to blame Owen, though, anyway, even though he's not in WCW at the time.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about how you guys all ended up in the WWE, because it was Brett and Jim and Davey and Dynamite. You guys went all there basically at the same time, from what I remember, 85.
Yeah, I think it. Brett and I got there at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Vince was taking all the Calgary guys. There's quite a few, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Nikolai Volkoff,
mm-hmm.
You, me.
Well, if you're going through the guys that went through there, there's Jake Roberts and there's JYD. And
Billy Graham.
Billy Graham. I mean, but talking from that 85
yeah,
period.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of guys that came from Calgary.
Oh, yeah. Here, Vince was taking guys like Junkyard Dog, you know.
Right.
And Jake Snake Roberts.
I think Jim was actually down here wrestling in Championship Wrestling from Florida.
Is this all had to do, though, when Vince sold, or when...
Yeah.
What was the story?
When
Stu sold the territory to Vince.
To Vince. And then I think part of it was that he would at least give them a look.
His family.
Yeah, Brett, Davey, Jim, and Dynamite. It's funny because, like, Dynamite was... And this is probably Bruce's story, not really mine. It's just I've heard it so many times. But Dynamite was such a hard sell for Bruce to bring him over to Calgary. And Bruce had seen him and wanted to bring Dynamite over and talked about...
He saw him in England.
Yeah, and was like, I need to bring this guy. He's going to change this whole company. And he's 180 pounds or something at the time. And Stu is very much the mindset of big guy, you know?
Sure.
And then fast forward a couple of years, and even... Even in like 2002, Stu's still telling me about Dynamite and how he was the best he'd ever seen. Mm-hmm. And like, so he made a point to like put him out over to Vince. You know what I mean? So like, it's funny that how much it,
sure,
Dynamite came in. Like Jim was saying, where they're all copying Dynamite and trying to like emulate him. And like, it just was very revolutionary. And so it's funny.
We had our own style out there, right, CJ?
Yeah, the Calgary style definitely exists.
There is a Calgary style.
I always
said that.
You have it.
Yeah.
You have it. I have it. It's a faster Memphis style,
mm-hmm.
You know.
And it's got elements of Japanese and European as well.
Yes, no, absolutely.
Definitely European. It's got some English and Japanese work in there.
Yes.
The Japanese work very fast.
Right.
Fast up, down, you know. There's no psychology. It's just one flat thing.
But even a little bit of lucha as well, because how I got really hooked into wrestling, I was hooked as a kid But when I saw Owen in 86 in Stampede Wrestling, they had put together this video called Hearts on Fire. It's a Bryan Adams song, and it was an Owen highlight reel. All of his, and I couldn't believe that somebody could do all this stuff, which was very much almost Mexican
and
style.
It's so funny. You always told me, just a different side note, about Owen jumping on like Mugga Singh's back,
and he would
and he'd backflip. Yeah. And I always thought it was one of those like wrestling things, like maybe you thought you saw it until this Owen DVD came out, and I see the highlight, and first thing I thought, Chris was 100% right.
Yep.
He really did jump off his back and do a backflip and stuck the and then right away hit a dropkick.
Yeah.
Exactly how Chris described it to me.
That was just kind of like you said, that Calgary style that was emulated from the guys that came.
Yeah, here you take something really wild and bizarre like that takes a lot of strength and balance.
Mm.
Doing stuff like that after being stuck in that van for 8 hours. Just popping out of that van for 8 hours, 9 hours.
And maybe that was the secret really to get everybody really wanting to work.
And going through the snow, too.
Right.
And being so damn cold and then going out there and doing moves like that. Mm-hmm. It was really crazy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But that's how you and me and all those Calgary guys, we had a little edge on everybody.
Yeah, I agree.
Because our style was much faster.
Mm-hmm. And also, too, I always say, you know, growing up in the cold weather, spending a lot of time up there, it toughens you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Well, we didn't come out there and end up like some of those southern Memphis wrestlers, Tennessee wrestling.
Yeah.
That real strange type of slow, unbelievable work.
Water pump spot where you take a guy's arm and you just go like this a bunch of times over your shoulder.
Which I think is what stood out, like you said earlier, like when they first all came to WWE, it took a little bit of time, obviously. You know, like Brett and Jim didn't just team up instantly. The Bulldogs did, I think, right? Or very close. Dynamite did a few shots here and there. Like, I've seen a match like Dynamite and Tiger Mask from MSG.
Right.
So, like, he did a few random shots, but through Japan, I think. But then when they all actually come into WWE in the mid-80s.
Yeah. There was a little bit of a style change.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, how did you and Brett end up being a team? How did the Hart Foundation?
Oh, for one thing, I needed someone. The traveling was so much in New York. I needed someone to drive the car.
So you needed a driver. But I mean, once again, getting put with, because you mentioned that you doing promos. Brett's promos at the time were very.
Brett had never really done any promos up to that time. Really, a little bit in Calgary, just a very little bit.
Yeah,
right.
And kind of the same with you though. You had done some, but.
I had worked Mid-South.
Okay.
And I did a bunch of interviews there.
Yeah.
But then
that really helped me.
But then also to put you with Jimmy Hart was a really, seemed like a real stroke of genius as well. And the fact his name was.
We've been using him ever since.
Yeah.
I think Jim might have been originally, I think he was managed by Jimmy Hart first.
Okay.
Like as a singles. And then I think Brett was, he's talked about it where he's supposed to do that cowboy Bret Hart. And as like a last. I guess he'd been pitching for a while, but as a last ditch thing was like, no, let's just try this team. And then
Brett was getting all ready to wear the cowboy hat and the vest and the chaps and everything for a wrestling gimmick.
Mm-hmm, as the cowboy.
Yeah.
But that was such a great team, though. Like the Hart Foundation, one of the greatest teams of all time.
Oh, Brett was a really, really great partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you guys, or at least what I've always seen, they get along great. If they see each other and they haven't seen each other in maybe a couple years, I guess, would be the longest. And Brett and Jim see each other, they are like right back to like, they don't miss a beat.
Mm-hmm.
A couple old gossiping old ladies.
But that's how it is, though. Like, you guys are together all the time. You see, you see Brett and Jimmy more than you're seeing your own family. So you go through the same things, ups and downs, and get pissed off at each other and then give each other a hug. And then, you know, I've always found that when you have a team and every night you guys are working together and you're traveling together, it's like being a married couple.
I got along really good with Brett. In fact, we still are proud of this little thing where no matter what happened out there, Brett and I never got in an argument or I disagreed on anything.
Really?
Yeah. We didn't have time for it.
I've never heard of them in any kind of argument. Or like I just saw Brett last month. I was up in Calgary. Same thing. He always has like positive, great stuff to say about Jim. I've never heard of them ever having any kind of dispute at all.
Which is really rare, actually.
Oh, yeah, because you know it's like having a tag partner.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, you guys are going to get in a fight or get upset.
Yeah.
You know, that's just part of the thing. But I never had a problem.
You guys never once ever got into a...
No, we were too experienced of the Calgary stuff.
Wow.
I think Brett had to talk him into the pink, though.
Oh, yeah. How did the pink come about?
We were trying to figure out a color. And because Vince likes color.
Yeah.
And so we ran like the light blue and black... And then that didn't go. We had the like a maroon and black.
Because you had the blue and dark for a bit, I remember, yeah.
And so here I saw on the first day, Adrian Adonis would had Jimmy Hart as manager too, and he came out with all pink. It's like, wow. And nobody's wearing pink. And so here Brett and I, we said, oh, screw this. Let's go all pink. Because Adrian's a Hart founder. Jimmy Hart is a manager. So Adrian, Jimmy Hart, and us, let's all wear the pink. And the first time Vince ever saw it, he loved the color. He loved it. And it really helped our career, I think, going with all pink.
It became, once again, it became one of your trademarks. And that's the thing I loved about the Hart Foundation is you. There was three of you, but Jimmy had the bullhorn. Brett had the shades. You had the goatee. It's like every guy had a specific gimmick within the confines of this group.
And I think what just hit me also, I don't know why I never thought of this, but like Brett and Jim are the first team at that around that time in that era that like were when you just said that, but they don't look the same. They're not.
Yeah, that's right.
Like Brett had the long hair and Jim had the flat top.
Yeah.
The Rockers look similar, and the That's Bulldogs true. Are similar, yeah. And like the Bolsheviks, and I mean, Powers of Pain, every team, Demolition, Legion of Doom, every
That's
team
a good point, DJ. Looks,
I didn't Very ever think point. About that till you just said the trademark thing, and I was like, wait a minute. And then I think that was maybe, I don't know if that was like a little thing that people didn't see, but it happened where it just they were the first team at that time that didn't look the same.
That's a good point.
Yeah, you got two tag guys, like the Killer Bees wore the same Killer Bee stuff.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah,
and the Bulldogs were the same Bulldog stuff.
Yeah, and you had, like you said, the Bolsheviks, the Russian guys, and then you had, you know, there's the Conquistadors.
Yeah, I mean,
same, and
all the Conquistadors.
So when you guys came in, because you mentioned too, you had that Calgary style. And
oh yeah,
who did you enjoy working with at that time?
Dynamite.
Yeah, right. The other Calgary guys, right?
Dynamite, Davey Boy, Duke Myers.
Yeah, but not in WWE though, right?
Oh, WWE, yeah.
WWE. So Dynamite and Davey Boy, like, so you had the British Bulldogs versus the Hart Foundation. That was a classic feud. But basically, it's just an extension of the Calgary territory. Were you getting great reactions from the crowds in the States that had never seen this before when you guys did those matches?
Yeah, because here we're working or that Calgary style, you know, mm-hmm. and people like that because it told a good story, but it was a little more high-paced,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all those Memphis guys where they wrestle, Jerry Lawler and that whole group.
Yeah.
That Memphis style, they barely do anything.
Right.
They walk around the ring with their buggy-whipped arms, you know, and do a lot of walking and talking and yelling for the first 20 minutes, you know.
Buggy-whip arms.
Most all the Memphis wrestlers, you have to have buggy-whip arms to be there.
That's a great point, though, because you think about it, even King will probably tell you, Jerry Lawler, Bill Dundee, you know, Jarrett's the buggy-whipped arms.
Jerry Lawler especially.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
But he's such a great wrestler and a great person, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't make any difference what he was.
Yeah, so smart psychology.
Oh, yeah. He was really bright. Yeah. Really.
What was your relationship with Vince at that point in time? Was he an accessible guy? Could you talk to him? Was he around all the time?
Oh, yeah. If I had a problem, I'd just call him.
Really?
Because we were so tired. You know, I was like, oh, you're going to fire me? Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm out of here.
There seems to be a theme when we're talking just about how the travel. Obviously, so was the travel something that really got to you after a while?
You're flying a jet every day. I always thought that the air on those planes, those jets, being pressurized like that messes with you. You're breathing that air in every day from a pressurized jet.
Well, it's not fresh air, that's for sure.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, sometimes if you're really tired, somebody they'll give you oxygen. This is like the opposite. It's like you're given this very contaminated air.
Yeah.
Which would do the opposite of what you want, right?
Well, you know, that's a good thing. You mentioned that, Chris, the contaminated air. Mm-hmm. See, the very first time that I'd ever worked indoors, here in the Calgary Pavilion, and I'm just trying to learn to wrestle a bit, and I was, you know, my wind wasn't really good. Mm-hmm. I've never really had a really good wind.
You could feel it being worse indoors.
Oh, yeah. The smoke. I couldn't handle the cigarette smoke and the cigar smoke in the pavilion. I was like, oh, my God, who's doing that?
It's like everybody.
Oh, yeah. Right? Oh, to wrestle those smoky arenas really bothered me.
That's another good point. You've never noticed that.
I've never, because we've been athletes my whole life in football, track and field, a little bit of baseball, but it's all outdoors.
I used to get that. I worked a lot in Mexico. And I would travel back and forth from Japan to Mexico. And when I would go to Mexico City, which is super high elevated, it's higher than Denver. you would work and then within 5 minutes just be so blown up, gasping for air, tasting that.
Those lungs are burning. That's a different feeling.
And it would take a couple of days to get acclimated, but sometimes, like you just said, I'd land from Tokyo, go straight to the arena, Mexico, and I would couldn't do anything. And you'd feel like, what the hell's wrong with me? Because of the altitude, the air is so thin as well.
Yeah.
Plus, people smoking. You know, that sort of thing. So when you started with the WWE, it was right when the big expansion started to where wrestling became a pop culture phenomenon.
I started the WWE at the end of WrestleMania 1, kind of coming in WrestleMania 2.
Right.
As were Brett and I think we started going there.
The famous Battle Royal is what I remember seeing for the first time.
Oh, God. Jim's told me this story before about the press slam out.
What was it, the WrestleMania 3 Battle Royal?
Two with Andre.
You and Andre were the final three guys.
Yeah. So here we're finishing the thing. I was so exhausted after 18, 20 minutes in the wrestling already. And then we're going to do the finish where the finish was. This whole idea sounded really good on paper at first. I get thrown out of the ring. I'm on the cement. So here's Brett messing with Andre. Brett runs into Andre's foot. And so I'm on the cement, and I get up, and I'm looking at him. And now Andre picks up Brett, and then Andre the Giant takes Brett over his head. I was like, oh, my God, you're too high. I said, I can't get it. I cannot get it. You're too high. It was way, way too high. We got to reevaluate this thing. And Brett's eyeballs were like huge. He didn't know. Imagine Andre picking you up and then looking at the ground. Like,
yeah, you're 7 feet. Press slam is another 3-4 feet. Yeah. You're like 12 feet above his head.
All at 12 feet.
Yeah.
I look at Brett and say, I don't think I can do it.
Because the idea is Andre is supposed to throw Brett on top of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the picking up Brett over your head with Andre, how tall is that?
Well, yeah. And plus you got the ring apron, which is seven is 11 plus, yeah, for you about 12 to 14 feet.
And so here Brett is about 240, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're catching a guy that was almost 250 pounds coming from that high.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You know, I said, well, I guess I have to try it, you know, come on. And so here Brett comes off and it's like, I used every bit of strength in my body to just try to stay fast.
Uh-huh.
And Brett hit me so hard, we pancaked the cement really hard. I was like, I knew it was going to be like that. You're too high. You're too heavy. Or you're too high.
He lands to a little lecture.
Were you yelling at him when he landed? Like, what's wrong with you?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was so cattywampus that as soon as I caught Brett on the floor, I just looked at him and said, are you all right? Are we okay?
Yeah. Are we in heaven?
It was too high, and it was too high impact.
Yeah.
After a long match, already got to.
But sure, of course. But
with NFL players.
Yeah.
So right. It's like.
Was that with the. No, that the NFL player was the WrestleMania.
I think they're in that one, right?
In Junkie. That one? That's right. No, WrestleMania 2.
Refrigerator Perry and stuff. They're in that WrestleMania 2 Battle Royal.
Well, yeah, because 2 was the one that came from.
From
all
three
the different
places, Chicago.
Oh, right.
LA.
So, you had all those NFL players in there as well.
Oh, they were a chore. Actually, those NFL football players, they'd never been in a ring before or wrestled, and they were glad to get the hell out of there.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because, you know, we could all kind of do our thing in the ring and all that, but then you throw a giant in the middle of that, and those big NFL football players, they go, what the hell is this? What do we do? What do you do with Andre? Whatever Andre wants.
That's right, yeah. What was he like as a guy, Andre?
Oh, he was a great guy.
Yeah?
He was a good drinking buddy of mine.
Oh, really?
Oh, you know, Andre got to the building, and they would have four or five different assortments of wines and champagnes and cognac and liqueurs and stuff. And he'd go through five or six full bottles of either of vodka or sangria or whiskey or all that to one time every night.
So they would have it there waiting for him?
Yep.
So when he got, wow.
He'd have it there when he first got to the arena.
Wow, before he had
so like Brett, we're wrestling Andre that night, and Brett and I are looking at Andre going, oh my God, he's drank that whole bottle of Yukon Jack. A whole bottle. It's like a half gallon size or something. God, oh my God. It's like, if I even took a couple of good gulps of that, I'd be so drunk.
Right.
You go, Andre, go out there and do that, and we go back to the bar and start all over again.
Man. Be able to drink that much.
He was a giant. I don't think
yeah,
he drank from the time he got up So time went to bed.
And I don't think people realize, too, when it's such a part of culture now, Andre the Giant, but like you see, keep saying, literal giant. Like,
yeah.
Big Show is a giant. Yeah. Kelly's a giant, but Andre was
I think Andre's close to Big Show, right?
I think so. I think Andre might have even been a little bit taller in his prime.
Before he started.
But you're also talking about a 70s giant where there was probably only him. Now there's a few guys in the world that are bigger. Just the fact that we had two giants in our company at the same time. Back then there was one giant and that was it, Andre.
Well, they had that English guy, Big Haystacks.
Was he an actual giant or was he just a big dude?
I wonder.
Like, you talk about guys that actually have the acromegaly.
That's a good question. He was pretty tall.
Yeah. But I think the actual, that condition, giantism.
Yeah, the acromegaly.
Acromegaly, right? Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about when you guys won the titles, the tag team titles, the championship. That was a big deal at that point in time because now championships change very quickly.
Oh, yeah. Brett and I were really excited. Like, oh, my God. We can't believe we're going to get the belts. Jesus Christ. So we're starting off as the 2 out of 3 falls. We're starting to start this match off. And Brett said, hits his turnbuckle really hard and busts the whole turnbuckle.
Wow.
And the turnbuckle and the ropes and everything, the top and the second rope came right off.
Really?
Now we got to finish this match with 20 minutes of this match. 2 out of 3 falls. And we're taking the belts. Ooh. It's like, now how? I said, Brett, well, how the hell can we do this with no ropes? We did it, but
not the.
It was really lackluster.
Who was it that you won the titles from? Was it Bulldog?
When they won, it's Bulldogs.
The Bulldogs.
I think Dynamite hurt his back like maybe a month or something before. So I think like Hardcore Nation jumps Dynamite from behind, and then so he's out, and then I think the match is just Davey against the Hart Foundation for the most part. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And then they beat Davey for the titles.
So the business is really expanding. You're talking about toys. You're talking about dolls, which they'd never had before. You're talking about, were you involved in the wrestling album? You know, you're singing now.
You're goddamn right, I'm in the wrestling album. That was a horrible day.
Please tell us about that.
Oh, my God. All those wrestlers, we had all up there, 3 or 4 levels of wrestlers, big rows, you know, everybody.
Yeah.
What a day that was.
So they have you guys singing?
Yeah, Land of 1,000 Dances.
And dancing.
And then so here, we're all doing this, and all of a sudden,
in gear,
Vince McMahon comes out and starts dancing like a ballroom dancer. Like he'd been doing his whole life. Like he's a Vegas showgirl or something. Went back to the stage, all the running and jumping and the dance. Like, oh my God, this is our promoter. Anyway, Vince can really dance.
Well, yeah, from that. How is he pitching this to you? Like, guys, this is what you're doing. Do your best, or else. Or is he like, okay, we're gonna try this, or like,
how? I was so tired. I was just on automatic pilot.
Yeah, just go over here. Do this. Do that. Right.
Yeah, it's like I'm not singing, so you can forget about the singing part.
But I'll dance.
Huh?
Yeah, but I'll dance.
In gear.
Yeah.
Everybody's in gear.
Let me ask you this, fast forward a few years to when you had the gimmick of Who.
Oh.
I really want to know.
What a nightmare that was.
I want to know, what was that supposed to be?
That was that old wrestling mask. I think it was Davey Boy's. It was hanging around the house for years.
Of course it was. Why wouldn't it be?
I tried it on. I was like, oh, God, this mask thing. So I got conned in and wearing that thing. And wrestling in a mask is very, very hard.
Oh, yeah.
You can't see out the sides.
Yeah, you get no peripheral vision.
Nothing. You got to look straight ahead, or you got to turn your whole body every time you look at somebody.
Yeah, like turn your whole torso to look to the
left. Yeah, exactly.
Right. It was a mask with a big question mark on it? Is that what it was?
No, it just was like this yellow mask with like red.
Okay. But the question mark was on the ass of the tights.
Maybe. Or just were the...
I don't remember any question marks.
Yeah, were the tights just yellow?
But the name was Who, so yeah. So maybe there wasn't a question mark. But what is the gimmick of Who?
We don't know. I was just glad to get that horrible gear off me. That was horrible.
So is this just because you're just, you're, like you said, just kind of an autopilot? Like, all right, if you want me to wear this gimmick, I'll wear it?
Yeah. You know, I'm used to wrestling in my... my tights, butcher top, and trunks, you know, because they're all used for support. And also, you take all that shit off, and you're just in a little pair of trunks. My God.
Right. You got the big abdomen. You got the big.
Yeah.
It's not. It's not a belly because it's not fat, but you have a big muscle.
The way you could breathe in this thing, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, the WHO mask we're just looking at right now. It's a yellow mask with a red eagle sort of thing on it. There you go. And you're WHO.
You cannot look at the way that thing's made.
There's no way you could breathe in that thing.
Oh, it was choking me because it's too tight.
Yeah,
it looks. You can't see out of the sides.
He's been around the house. It probably smells of cat piss.
We had a diet.
Yeah, you guys dyed it yellow, right? Ellie dyed it yellow.
But then, you know, when you were talking about the Heart Foundation, there was the original Heart Foundation. Then there's the other version of the Heart Foundation with the five of you guys. When you're talking about Brett, Davey, Owen, Pillman, and Neidhart, which was another classic team in the WWE history.
Yeah, that was a really good idea of them. You know, they throw those teams together a little bit. And in the Survival Series?
Yes.
And then it was so good that you go off, you wrestle off your spinoffs from that, you know?
Don't we mean like other pay-per-views or going on the road?
Like spinoffs of the teams, right? Is what you mean? Like where you, like this guy, like out of the whole group of things, like maybe these two guys, like kind of like, I think like the Canadian Stampede is like that 5-on-5 and out of that, it's like at the SummerSlams, like Owen and Steve Austin.
Oh, okay. Right. But do you remember that Calgary Stampede pay-per-view, how crazy that was? It was in the Saddle Dome.
Yeah.
It was 5-on-5. Heart Foundation against Austin.
Legion of Doom. Yeah. Ken Shamrock, Gold Dust.
Yeah. Do you remember that night?
Oh, yeah.
Just how loud that was and how amazing that was?
Oh, it was really, really loud.
Yeah. It was a great kind of revitalization of the Heart Foundation.
Oh, yeah. I can just remember one thing about that night you don't forget. When we made the hot tag.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big roar from the crowd that I've never heard anywhere yet.
Yeah.
It was really, really good.
I can
vouch for that. That's basically what we all want to do in our business. That's the idea of the whole wrestling thing.
Yeah.
Is to get that pop at the end and make people yell a little bit in the middle and at the finish. And if you did that, you're doing your job.
You're right. And to get that, it's the pop that you never forget. It's like, you know, it's because, you know, you wrestle time and time again, and there's so many matches you don't remember, but the ones that you remember that have that magical moment, that's why we do this. Like every night you go to the ring, maybe tonight.
Yeah.
You'll hit
the jackpot. In the pavilion now in Calgary, because the way that place is built, like a little miniature stadium with a ceiling.
Yeah, right.
When that place was packed and you pop that place, oh, man, that was that big.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was really huge.
Well, and like you mentioned, too, with the Calgary Stampede, I remember the Saddle Dome was just jam-packed, sold out.
Yeah, it was during the week of Stampede, too. So, I mean, yeah, it was insane that day.
It was a real heart.
And that was kind of all new in that Saddle Dome, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they hadn't seen that before. Let's talk a little bit about the Montreal screw job. You know, you always hear about it from Sean and Brett's perspective. But I've never heard about it from a backstage perspective, especially since now that Owen and Davey are gone, and Pillman too. So you're the one guy from a backstage standpoint. What was your take on everything?
I was sitting next to Pat Patterson.
Uh-huh.
And Pat and I, we just looked at this big mess, you know, this big pileup, and we just sat there. I think I managed to end up on the top after the whole deal was over. It was a big dog pile of about 8 feet high of people.
Afterwards, backstage?
Yeah. No, in the ring.
Oh, in the ring.
I think everybody's trying to grab Brett or Vince or pull him apart or some shit.
Did you run out to the ring? Or you were in the back? Because what went down was that when...
Okay, so the bell rings, then kind of the pay-per-view goes off the air, like Sean quickly raises the title, goes off the air. Then there's been the footage, I think... Like, for sure,
Brett's throwing the monitors and
Davey, Owen's out there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Then is it Davey and Jim?
Or and you
is
came
it,
out there too?
I think they're out there. For sure, Owen is out there. And I think Jim might be out there when Brett's smashing the monitors and signing WCW to
I remember
air.
Being in the ring and watching Brett break everything.
Yeah, so Jim's out there, and then they go to the back.
What was your reaction when the finish happened, though, Jim? Were you thinking, like, this isn't right, or did you know there was a screw job, or were you thinking maybe they changed the finish? Or when you're watching it in the back, what was your reaction?
I was like everybody else. I was wondering, what the hell is going on here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I basically just came out and kind of watched Brett's back a little bit, and that was about it.
Was Brett saying anything to you?
I don't think so at the time. He was pretty well busy.
Yeah. Busy. Now, afterwards, though, there's also the you know, Vince went in the room and Brett and Vince had the little, you know, exchange. Brett punched Vince out. Were you in that room at the time?
I was right next to him.
Tell us what happened.
It was like Brett sitting over one side of the locker room. Here comes Vince. And Brett just got up and they went right into it, right in a big fight there. So everybody piled on top. It was a huge dog pile.
Dog pile in the dressing room. Now.
Yeah, in the dressing room.
There's one outside in the ring. Now it's in the dressing room.
And I think I can barely remember Pat Patterson. He was like, he got stuck in the middle of it. Then I said, oh my God, Pat's in the middle of the dog pile. He's almost on the ground. I said, Pat, are you all right? Good.
Right. So did you want to stay in WWE? Were you pissed off? Were you just a guy making a living to support your family?
I was just making a living. Yeah. You know, I said, I don't have a contract yet, you know?
Yeah, at the time, Jim's just working like a handshake deal.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So he actually is on like Raw, not that next week, but maybe like a couple weeks later, like he joins DX, then they turn on him, and then the next week he does something else. So he's still on Raw a couple weeks after that, before Owen comes back and starts fighting with
right,
DX.
Right, the big yeah. return, right. Because you end up, because that's when I met you in WCW, you came to WCW, I don't know if it was maybe a few months afterwards or whatever. Was it one of those things where when Brett went to WCW, he said, Jim, come on over and I'll get you a contract over here and don't worry about what's going on in WWE right now?
Something like that.
Yeah. Did you like WCW?
Oh, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, oh, I really liked it.
Yeah?
I've never made so much money to do absolutely nothing.
Absolutely.
You know, go to these things and get paid a really decent salary and then not wrestle. It's like, wow, did these guys know what they're doing? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, like, someone tell me I'm getting paid a lot of money just to stand here in the locker room and do nothing.
And as
to drink beer at night.
And a seasoned vet would know, like, this is not going to last.
Oh, yeah. We all loved it. It's like, you know, we better enjoy what we got, you know. These people at the WWE obviously don't know what the hell they're doing. We know that.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was thinking. I always noticed that because we were, you know, my group of guys with, you know, Eddie Guerrero and Malenko and Benoit, you guys would come in, Davey and Jim and Brett and Henning, who was great as well. And you guys were always like, listen, you know, this place is screwed up. And for us, we weren't the seasoned vets and we didn't have the big contracts, but just watching what you guys were saying, it's like, I got to get out of here, man. I got to go to New York as quickly as possible because if Anvil and Henning and all these guys are saying this place is going down. You know what I mean? It gave me a lot of perspective from the veteran standpoint. But I'm just talking about when you're saying that they're just spending a lot of money for you to just stand around.
Oh, yeah.
Because it wasn't just you. It was a lot of guys.
The WCW, yeah.
Yeah, right. That's what I was talking about, WCW. Yeah, never WWE, but...
No, if you work for the WWE, if you got paid that money in the WWE, you'd be wrestling every night.
Yeah, on top, right?
I just couldn't believe those guys in the WCW.
Just to hang around.
I couldn't get over it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you put your wrestling gear on, like, and I got my gear on, I'm at the building here, and you don't want me to wrestle? Why would you have me do this? Put my gear on, sit in the locker room and not wrestle.
Yeah. I remember one time I showed up and Kevin Sullivan goes, he was the booker. I showed up for Nitro. He goes, what are you doing here? I'm like, nothing, I guess. When the booker asks you, what are you doing here? It's like, not a lot, apparently. I guess I'll just go. So let's fast forward to now, Jim. And it's funny, too, because, you know, once again, Natty and TJ now, too, stars in a whole different area on Total Divas. And you've been on Total Divas as well. What do you think of this whole reality TV thing and having a camera in your face? And how is that for you after being in show business for so long?
I love it. I love it. You know, I'm working with my daughter and some people, you know, all that's really easy. It's easy for us because we're used to being in front of the camera and, you know.
Yeah. And it's like a whole different, it's a whole different way to have your career continue on. You don't have to take bumps.
Yeah.
And they love Jim. He always is like turned on instantly and like hasn't aired yet. But like, and I never know what parts are going to air, but we did a little like family vacation last month and like. Natty's getting him to try on, like, he puts on this hat that's like an umbrella, like, on top of a hat, and, like, he has, like, no qualms about it. He just puts it right on, you know? And,
why not?
They love it. Jim, like, plays ball, and, like, they love it. They absolutely love it. He's turned on the second that, like, the camera's there. He gets it.
Show business, man.
Yeah.
Sing and dance, too, if they
want to. TJ and I love that. It was made for us.
Yeah. And also, too, having daughters, and my one daughter I have 9-year-old twins, and my daughter Cheyenne. If my daughters were going to be, anyone in my family was going to be a wrestler, would be my daughter Cheyenne. How was it for you when Natty said that she wanted
to
be
a wrestler? I'm always the last one to know everything.
Really? I'm sure she's probably a little scared to tell you, maybe.
Well, you know, her Natty, if she's going to learn the wrestling business, what does she do? She goes to Japan and wrestles those Japanese wrestlers to learn how.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. The women are really gonzo.
Would you have taught her, though? Would you have trained her if she would have asked you to, or try to help her out?
I don't know. I never thought of that. But the Japanese women wrestlers are absolutely kamikaze gonzo bonsai. they really beat the shit
very
out of each other.
Style, right. Very strong style.
Oh, those women. Yeah, they drop kicks off the top to the floor and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I'm just wondering, like, thinking about my little girl getting into a ring where she's going to get her ass kicked around, you know, and also, too, just knowing how corrupt the business could be at times. Were you happy about her doing it, or was it her decision and whatever she was going to do, she was going to do?
I'm always the last one to know anything. So,
had you known first, it might have been a different outcome.
Well, see, Natty's a fairly good athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I got the girls into more sports when they're in junior high and high school.
Are you proud of her as a wrestler, too?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she's definitely got the heart. Once again, that Calgary style. She's got
You know, she loves it, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, last question, Jim. Out of all the matches that you've had, is there one you could pick out as being your favorite match, or a couple matches that stand out for you as being your favorites?
I like that WrestleMania 3 match we had with the Bulldogs.
Yeah, Bulldog. Was it a six-man?
Oh, yeah, with Danny Davis and Tito Santana, right?
Yeah, I kind of like that one.
That's the
I like doing those six-man tag or eight-man tags.
Mm-hmm. Classic, too, the WrestleMania 3 at the Pontiac Silverdome with so many
people
on a monumentous night and everything.
Yeah, sold out crowd there in Pontiac.
Yeah.
I don't remember too many arenas that weren't sold out.
At that time?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that when I first came to WWE for the Attitude Era.
Oh, yeah.
In 2000, 99, 2000, they were all sold out. Every house show, every spot show. It was so hot at the time, no matter where you went.
Oh, yeah.
It was sold, you know?
Yeah, I remember you guys coming to Calgary, and it was like a live event, and it was sold out.
Saddled them, yeah.
And I was like, man, this is pretty serious. A live event sold out here, this is pretty real.
What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite Heart Foundation or
Heart Foundation
moment?
Canadian Stampede definitely sticks out in terms of like, it's almost like kind of sad, but it was really the last time that, like, you know, besides the ring and the crazy atmosphere, but it's also the last time the family was kind of all together as a unit. Because after that is a screw job, so then kind of like Owens stays in WWE and they go to WCW, which, you know, Davey wasn't even there like a year. He's back mm-hmm. in 99 and Owens' tragedy. And the family has never really been the same since. Right? So like that, and there was a big barbecue at Stu's after because of the time difference. So the pay-per-view started at like 5 our time, and it's only a 2-hour in your house. So 7, we'd have Sunday dinner normally anyway. So it was like a week-long cleanup at Stu's, but there was a huge barbecue afterwards too. Mm-hmm. So like the show and the crazy atmosphere, and then it continued on over at Stu's. That's definitely up there. And of course, you know, any Bulldogs match, Harvard Nation Bulldogs, definitely sticks out.
Yeah, just great. Such great chemistry for sure. Is he a good father-in-law?
He's great. He's very easy to
look on Jim's face. Of course I am. What do you expect?
He's funny. Every time he comes over, he's like asking me about my neck, and he's very easy to get along with. Like when we go see Natty's sister and her two kids, it's about a 3-hour drive, and it's always the same Natty and her mom in the back, and then I'm driving and Jim's up front, and I just, same thing as like you today, I just ask him. That's why I was able to kind of fill in on some stuff, because I ask him a million like Heart Foundation questions and like Wrestling Demolition, or like, I hadn't seen it until maybe Brett's DVD, but like they used to do where Brett would slingshot Jim into the ring.
Yeah.
But there's one against Demolition where Brett's on the apron and Jim's on the inside and he slingshots him to the floor.
Wow.
Yeah, Madison Square Garden.
So you did kind of like a tope over the top rope onto the floor into the Demolition.
Well, here we have we're in Madison Square Garden, and the cameras, we did it right in the hard way camera side.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 2 out of 3 fall. I think it was a long match. Like, oh, God, I can't believe I'm actually going to do this thing for this whole match. I'm exhausted. In fact, can I do this?
I hope so. But out over the ropes onto the floor for me, like, ooh, I hope I haven't overdone it here.
Yeah.
You slingshot yourself over the top ropes. You know, I know it's easy for you guys, but for a heavier guy, if you happen to hook your knee pads
on the way over,
you're going down.
But not to mention, too, with the way that you're doing the catapult, you only have so much momentum to go. Like, it's not like you're going to the side. You're going
straight
forward.
You better get it timed up.
That's right. You better get a slingshot because you're coming over head first.
Yep.
So when you did it, did they catch you okay? It went good?
Yeah, it went.
Barry Darso, right? He always tells me, like, oh, he's like, Barry Darso, I could trust.
I wouldn't have done it with anybody else except Barry Darso.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Plus, I've been wrestling with Barry. He was my tag partner and in Florida Championship Wrestling. He was a great tag partner.
Really? It's always a lot easier to do those type of moves, high-risk moves, when you're working with someone that you're friends with and that you know.
Oh, yeah. You know? That's like second nature for us, you know?
Yeah.
I would be doing that with anybody that I didn't really, really know well.
Right, really trust. And conversely, too, you've known TJ since he was... Did you know him when you were a kid? Because you always hang around the house.
Yeah, and like he lived down here in Tampa, but they would come up. Like, I definitely met Jim, like, probably the latest, like, maybe 93, like, maybe came up for a show at the Saddle Dome, a live event.
Gotcha, so you've known him since he was a kid.
Oh,
Yeah. Did you always think he'd get into wrestling?
Once you hang around Sue's house enough and through the basement and all that, it's pretty much your destiny's cut out for you.
and funny enough, when Jim was working in Memphis as like talent scout, so this is like 2000. I remember he pulled myself and Teddy Hart aside and took pictures of us and wrote a little bio on us of recommending us to developmental in 2000. And he's the first guy of all things. He told me about Daniel Bryan at the time because he was in Memphis.
Okay.
And Spanky kept telling me about this guy Spanky and how, you know, he blows these kisses and it's kind of weird but pretty cool. And like
that would be Brian Kendrick, right?
Yeah. So like exactly. he I remember he'd always say it. So, you know, if you do end up there, just remember, like, I was the first guy that really wrote that report. So just, you know, joking around, but he'd always throw it out there.
Last thing, TJ, quickly, how's your neck coming along?
Neck feels pretty good. Tomorrow I go see my surgeon for my six-month checkup. And even for me, like, the time's flown. You know, I know 6 months is gone by fast, but, like, even in my shoes where, like, I'm able to work out, which is able to combat some of the insanity of being at home.
Because that's the thing, being on the road is crazy, but then being at home for a long period of time,
people don't realize how all of our necks are very, very sensitive.
Yeah.
And all the bumps we're doing.
Right.
Falling on the cement with your head.
No, absolutely. No, and even the injury that you had, I was reading about it.
Yeah.
Like 5% of people basically survive.
Yeah.
And like 2%
and those that do are
quadriplegics.
So like Natty's done a couple... I won't go on, but Natty's done, like, she filmed something with Nikki for Total Divas, and they went to a chirogenic place, and then Nicole said, I wonder if this would be good for TJ, and then the guy said, oh, who's TJ, and they're talking, and Natty showed him my x-ray, and he's like, ma'am, I have to ask, but is your husband paralyzed?
Mm-hmm.
And Natty said, no, and he was like, how? And I don't know if you've met him, the heart doctor that comes and checks on us once a year, twice a year. Unbelievable memory. Like, you know, myself, Cody, we have really good wrestling memories. This guy's memory is unbelievable. Like, and I remember I saw him the last time. He's like, oh, how's the mom doing up in Calgary and this and this? And I was like, man, how do you remember this stuff? Like, I understand there's probably a chart that says, like, you know, I'm from Calgary, but how do you remember that my mom only, there's no dad? You know what I'm saying? Like, anyway, he was there not too long ago and he said, and he's like, oh, where's TJ? I haven't seen him today. And he said, oh, he had an injury and same thing, showed him the x-ray. And he said, I hate to ask, but he's not paralyzed, is he? So, the fact that, like, who knows how I survived it.
Because talking to you, we're sitting on a couch, the anvil's across from us, and we've been looking at each other all day, and I forgot that you have neck problems.
Yeah, and I think I'm the only guy in WWE to have the fusion this high up. It's the C1 and 2. It's as high as it gets.
And that's the dangerous
part. Yeah, I was kind of getting antsy in the hospital. I was in San Antonio for 3 days. I'm kind of getting antsy, and I wasn't on any painkillers. I was in discomfort, and I had the neck brace on at the time, the collar, but they'd unhooked me from everything.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come in my room and check my blood pressure and my temperature every couple hours, and they were working on an airlift to Tampa.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, here's the thing. there's an airport 20 minutes away and there's a flight in 2 hours. So I'm going to be on that flight. And they're like, no. And I wasn't getting belligerent by any means. It's not my style, but I was getting agitated. Right. This is day three on this. I said, I have a really nice mattress at home. I'm not, you guys are checking my temperature and I understand, and I'm not in pain, so I don't need anything here, but I'm in discomfort. I'm just sitting here. And finally this woman came in and she was like, well, listen, you have the same injury as Christopher Reeve, but for some weird reason, she said, for, you know, but you survived.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like, you should have, you know, by the percentage of it, you should have asphyxiated in the ring and
basically died.
Yeah. And somehow you didn't do that and you're not paralyzed. So please just understand. Yeah. And I instantly calmed down and I said, you're 100% right. And I'm at your mercy.
Yeah.
No problem.
You know, you're talking about winning the lottery.
Yeah.
You won the lottery twice on that.
Yeah. Crazy. And then even the surgery, supposed to be 2 hours and it took a little over four. And, so they had to go through the back. 'Cause it was like, I joined the weird, like broken neck club. And there's one advantage is like, Steve Austin and Kurt Angle reach out to you all the time and Edge, but Edge has always been awesome with me from when I was in FCW. So
and what did Steve text you?
So he texts me like, hey, you got to take care. Like, hey, how's everything? How's that stack of dimes? And in brackets, he says neck.
Yeah, that's a wrestling like, term. Stack of dimes. How's that stack of dimes?
And I'm like, I know it means neck, but he messaged me right away and he said, kid, why did they go through the back of your neck like that? Why didn't they go through the, everything's through the front? I said, Steve, it's so high up. It's the equivalent of my mouth.
Wow.
And then he's like, oh, yeah, they can't go through the front then. Even I went to the dentist like last month and they did x-rays because it was a new dentist because we moved. And I'm so used to it now. I totally forgot. And they're like, do you have metal in your neck? And I was like, oh, yeah, I do. Like, oh, we weren't sure or if our x-ray machine had messed up. And I saw the thing and I was like, oh, where I had the thing I had to bite down on for the x-ray was like right aligned with like the work in the neck.
It's
crazy.
So you're coming along and getting better and that's
yeah, I mean, I feel, you know, can't explain it, but I feel as good as possible.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. What's the
See, that's
better?
Coming from a Calgary boy. Calgary.
That's right.
Sami Zayn has dubbed it Calgary crazy because he's running the Teddy Hart and stuff, but he's watched like Brad interviews and Jim interviews and he's a student of the game. He's watched everything Zayn, but he even like will send injury texts back and forth because his shoulder and stuff. And he's like, man, you're just Calgary crazy. He's like, that Calgary crazy. It's a real thing. It's a real thing.
As you said, it is, right, Jim?
Oh, yeah. The way Stu ran us out there. My God.
They call us in Japan the Calgary Kids. If you came from that area, I remember I saw an article in a magazine once of the Calgary Kids, and you talk about an all-star lineup of guys.
Well, I think you guys can all agree with you. All those Calgary guys have that style.
Yeah, style, but that toughness too.
It's the toughness, but it's that our Calgary style has a little bit of Japanese, a little bit of American, a little bit of English wrestling in it.
Yeah. And just and then just
what's the thing? It's like you, right? Like you broke your arm and you still wrestled that night. I tore my knee. I was too stubborn and I made sure I wrestled the next day. I knew I was going to eventually get surgery, but it was like the after Christmas loop. So it's kind of like I could kind of slide by for a couple of days because of the holidays. Mm-hmm. So like I forced them to let me wrestle that next day. But even with my neck, I walked to the back.
Yeah. Oh, that's
and like
crazy
it's too. Just that it's just that weird. I don't know what why we're wired like that. But it's just a weird thing.
Happy to be there.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
No, thank you.
Thanks, Anvil.
Thank you, Chris.
It was a blast, man.